The question is, what is the relationship between duty and Swadharma? There is first a concept of duty, which is determined by the position that one occupies in a social framework. There is first a society, and society produces a social framework. Social framework is produced by creation of institutions. Institutions are interrelationships of human beings with certain kind of uniformity, regulations, and certain aims to be achieved. Marriage, for instance, is an institution. This institution is a part of the totality of the framework of the society. Now, marriage is an institution connected with what we call the institution of the family. Family usually forms a part of a larger framework of a clan, of a group. That group again has a role to play in a larger framework of the whole of the country. The country again forms a part of the totality of the world. Now, every human being is a kind of a knot from where various kinds of threads arise, and all these threads are threads of relationships. In other words, every human being is a knot of a network of relationships. No human being can be conceived without considering the relationships that the individual possesses or has in regard to the others. Now, these others are related in different ways. In a sense, you might say that every human being is related to the whole of humanity. Therefore, is a member of the society of humanity as a whole. Some people might even extend and say that every human being is a part of the totality of the whole world, not only human beings, but of the whole world. Aapko idhar baithna hai ki idhar baithna hai? Nahi, nahi, aap idhar aa jaiye. So a human being, the question is, what is the relationship between duty and Swadharma? So I am explaining that the concept of duty arises from the relationship that an individual has in connection with social framework. The position that one occupies in the society determines the duty. Now I am explaining in a larger way, the concept of society and the concept of institutions in which society is interlocked. So, in a larger sense, you might say that every individual is a member of the whole human society, all human beings. In a larger sense, every human being is a part of the totality of the world, including human beings and animals and creatures. Still larger is, every human being is a member of the world, taking also inanimate things. It's a large concept of a human being. And actually, human being is connected with all the living, non-living, and the entire universe. In a certain sense, you might say that every action that we perform, even the breathing, is impossible without the structure of the world being what it is. We all depend upon oxygen. Oxygen depends upon the position of the planet in the solar system, and the solar system is what it is because of the entire universe being what it is. So all that we are depends upon the totality of the universe. In fact, Buddha had a very powerful statement which says that any thought that you even think in your mind travels all over the universe, and exactly at the right moment it comes back to you with all its consequences. This is his concept of karma, law karma. Karma is such a thing that you cannot avoid it. It is not as if I have done something and then I can say that now I forget about it because I don't look at it. Well, I have forgotten about it. According to Buddha, even a thought that you have thought has a power of traveling all over the world and comes back to you, specifically to you, from where it has originated, with all its consequences. Therefore, you cannot escape the consequences of whatever you think, you feel. So even the action that you do, even in the form of a mental thought, has its consequence. That is why Buddha says that you keep your mind absolutely clean and have continuously goodwill, continuously. Na vairena vairam shamyati. By revenge, no revenge can be quelled or quieted. Therefore, he said that your answer should be always of goodwill. Whatever is being done unto you by others, even if you feel injustice is being inflicted upon you, from your side there should be a continuous goodwill. This is the Buddha's important teaching. And the reason is that he saw the interrelationship between the individual and the whole universe, which you cannot avoid. Now, this is the largest concept of man and the society, human being and the society. In these days, the word man is not very often to be used because people feel that man excludes woman, although the language of English people who made the language, they gave us only one word, man, for everything, saying that man includes woman. But now there is a feminist movement which says that you should not use the word man, you should use the word human being, so that both men and women are included. In Sanskrit, we have got the word manushya, which is both man and woman. But such a word does not exist in the English language. So now they are trying to modify the English language. So they say you should not use the word mankind, you should use the word humankind. You should not use the word man, you should use the word human being, and so on. The one recommended now that you should, whenever there is a reference to singular, and try to make the pronoun plural if possible, because if it is singular, then afterwards you have to use pronoun either his or her. There you have no choice at all. You can't use such a word which will include both his and her. So they said that instead of using the singular, you use plural, and then you can say there, because there is a word which is applicable to both men and women. So one has to be very careful in these days to use the English language. So in any case, what Buddha said was that every human being is connected with the totality of the universe. Now, even though this is true in a general way, every human being happens to be a member of a group which is inevitable. Even if you have a largest society in the world, it cannot function as an institution. It has to be limited in some way so that you can actively participate as a member of a group. So there is a totality of which you are a part. Then there is a kind of a group to which you belong. And it is through a group that you belong to the totality. The smallest group around an individual normally is that of family, because biologically there is a necessity of having right from childhood, your birth itself depends upon a combination of two persons at least. If the present biological methods are accepted, maybe in future it may not be absolutely inevitable, but this is the smallest group that a human being has, that is of a family. And family itself is sustained by larger groups and so on. Now the idea is that whenever you become a member of a group, then the group tends to impose upon you as a member certain obligations for the sustenance of the group. The moment you are a member of a family, the family imposes upon you certain obligations. As a child, therefore, when right from the beginning has got certain duties towards the family, and the father and mother have certain duties towards the child, and duties to others, not in the family, but others who sustain the family and the institution of the family. So it is in this way that there is a chain of obligations. Now the idea of duty is confined to this concept of the position that you occupy in a social framework. Now this idea of obligation is dependent upon what group thinks is salutary for the sustenance of the group. Now that concept may be right, may be wrong, but as long as you belong to a group, the thinking of the group is imposed upon you, and it is the group which decides what is your duty and which is not your duty. Now this idea, duty as something imposed upon every individual by virtue of what the social framework thinks is salutary for you and for the family and for the group to achieve, may be in conflict with what smaller groups think as against what the larger groups think. And what a group thinks in regards to the individual and what a group, what an individual feels in regard to what is imposed upon him from the family, from the smallest group. Therefore, the idea of duty has been a constant subject of controversy. Is it really my duty to do this or to do that? As a result, there have been in the whole world a tendency to produce what are called codes of conduct. Every society, whether you like it or not, in one time or the other, it begins to frame a code of conduct, which is discussed or which is imposed. And ultimately, the individual is brought into a kind of a chain and is obliged to do something or the other. In India, we have a large number of dharma shastras in which the entire aim is to lay down what is dharma of each individual. Now this dharma shastra in India has a larger meaning of duty than what is normally thought in other countries. Dharma as understood in India is also connected with the ultimate end of life, ultimate aim of life. What is the ultimate aim of life was discussed at length in India. Perhaps there is no history in the world where such a long debate on the ultimate end of life was discussed. Now, evidently, you cannot know what is the ultimate end of life, of aim of life, unless you know the totality of life. what is human life? You cannot decide what is human life when you are a child, because you are not crossed all aspects of life, so you cannot say that this is the best thing in life to do. Even when we are young, youthful, we cannot decide, because many problems of all ways you do not know, so you cannot decide what are the problems and for which you have to do one thing or the other. Even if you go through the whole life, nobody will say that I have had full experience of life, all aspects of life. That also nobody can claim. So the question was, right from the beginning, is there anybody who knows the totality of life, and having known the totality of life, can tell us what is the ultimate end of life? This was the search of the Vedic rishis. You know the totality of life, as it were, you can say that I have gone beyond the horizon. Horizon normally is a blockade beyond which you normally cannot look. But to go beyond horizon, and if you open one horizon, another horizon arises, and you can say, I have gone horizons after horizon. And therefore, in the Veda, we speak of a dawn succeeding a dawn. And succession of dawn. And rishis claim that they have seen succession of dawns. And having seen all that, and having seen Paramam, Paramam Jyotihi, having crossed everything, you might say, if there are 7 oceans or 14 oceans, whatever there are, they have crossed all that. The Vedic rishis claim that they have seen all, everything. Having seen everything, now they can say what is the ultimate end of life, and therefore what each individual should do. Once I have told you of the mantra that was given by the teacher of Sri Krishna to Sri Krishna, and it is a very short mantra, and it is said that having heard that mantra, Sri Krishna became a woman. This is the story in Chandogya Upanishad. Rishi Ghora was the teacher, and Sri Krishna, the son of Devaki, was given the mantra by his teacher, and on hearing that one word, he became fully human. And I told you what was that mantra. Udvayam samasas kariswaha pasyanta uttaram devam devatra surya maganma jyotir uttamam. This is the mantra that was given by Ghora to Sri Krishna. Now it says in a very simple way, but it claims so much. It says that we cross tamasaspari, we cross all darkness. Then we came to a higher light, jyotir uttaram, swaha pasyanta, we perceived swaha. Swaha has a certain meaning, but says that having gone from darkness, we went to swaha, and having seen swaha, we realized that there was still something more. Then we went to suryam aganma jyotir uttamam. Then we perceived the highest light, jyotir uttamam, the highest light, which was surya. Now surya is a symbolic word, swaha is a symbolic word, tamas is a symbolic word. So there are 3 planes, tamas, swaha, and surya. And the claim is that when you cross the darkness, you first come to higher light, which is swaha, and then you cross over and you come to surya, and you see the supreme light, jyotir uttamam, beyond which there is nothing, because it is uttamam. It is the highest. This is the claim of the rishis. We say that we saw all this. The word swarga has come from the word swaha. That is why we say that if you know what is swarga, it's a very great knowledge. But according to the Veda, swarga is only an intermediate knowledge. You have to go into the sunlight itself. The surya stands for what Sri Aurobindo calls the supermind. Supermind is the highest knowledge. How do you know it is the supreme light? Because it has the world of creation. It is that consciousness which can create at will. In our mental consciousness, when I see this table, I am obliged to see this table because it is not dependent upon me to see the table or not to see the table. I am obliged to see the table the moment I open my eyes because it is there. Therefore, my mind is not the highest faculty. The highest faculty is one which is capable of creating what you really want before you. Now, such is the power of the Uttamam Jyotihi, that light which is the highest. Now, this power the Vedic Rishis possess, therefore they could say that this is now the highest light. If I want to see this, this is said that Vishwamitra attained to that power by which he could create a new world. That was the legend of Vishwamitra. Now, this is the power, having achieved which, they claim we have reached the supreme light. Now, our concept of dharma has arisen on the basis of this. Consult those who have seen the totality of the world, totality of life, the highest end of life, and they have achieved the highest end of life. Having read this, they conceived of a concept which was called Rida. The Veda is very famous by its concept of Rida. Rida means the rights, which is based upon truth. You can do the right action when you know the truth. That is why in the Veda, you have Rita and Satya always together. There is a third word also, which is called Brihat, the vast. In the Atharveda, there is a mantra which says that the whole prithvi is based upon Brihat, Ritam and Satyam. The whole physical universe, by prithvi is not meant only the earth as we know it. By prithvi is meant everything that is physical, the entire universe is based upon Brihat, the vast, which is Ritam, which is right, and which is Satyam, which is truth. The truth, the right, and the vast. Now, according to the Veda, the whole universe is governed by vastness. Wherever there is narrowness, you break that narrowness. This is the one message of the Veda. Anything that imprisons you is not right. The basic condition of truth and right is the vastness. That is why the idea of freedom is given so much of importance in the Veda and the whole Vedic tradition. Be free. Be vast. In that vastness, you will see the highest truth. And based upon that truth, you will be able to decide what is the right thing to do. That is the idea of Rita. Rita is the right action that proceeds from the perception of the truth, which is based upon the perception of the vast. Now, this is the Vedic teaching. From here has arisen the concept of dharma. Now, the word dharma is taken from the root dri. In Sanskrit, there is a root verb called dri. Dri dharati, that which holds. This whole world is nothing but something which is a network of relationships, a network which is held together. Therefore, that which holds everything together is dharma. The Vedic rishis had found out that the whole world is held together by a knowledge which they call supramental knowledge, Jyotir Uttamam. The supramental knowledge only can hold everything together. That is why it is said that every human being should try to attain to the supreme knowledge. It is only supreme knowledge which can tell you what is the truth. It is that which can do the right. When the right action is done, everything is held together. From this idea of dharma arose dharma shastras. Now, unfortunately, the vision of the rishis was not shared by all those who came after the rishis. There was a lapse of that knowledge. As Sri Krishna himself says in the fourth chapter, that this knowledge was given by me in the earliest time to Vivaswan, and from there it came to Manu, and then it came to Ikshvaku, and then it got lost. So this knowledge of Rita, of the supermind, of Jyotir Uttamam, all that knowledge got forgotten. Fragments remain. On the basis of the fragments, the successors of the rishis began to make codes of conduct. Naturally, therefore, these codes of conduct have never been claimed in India as supreme because of this background. Therefore, it is said that if there is a conflict between codes of conduct and the Veda, then you should prefer Veda to the codes of conduct. But this is in theory. Who will find out whether something is in conflict with the Veda or not? It requires again a tremendous knowledge. That being absent, gradually the power of the codes of conduct became very powerful.
That is Manusmriti, sir.
Manusmriti, there are so many smritis.
Codes of conduct.
So many smritis. So it is said that Veda is Shruti. It is a direct contact with the divine. But what is remembered is for smriti. So that is why in India, dharma shastras came to be formulated in the form of smritis. And there are so many smritis, Yajnavalkya smriti, Narada smriti, so many smritis are there. Even among them there are clashes. Therefore in India, what is dharma is even today not an established fact. Even today, there is a controversy whether this is according to dharma or not. The fortunate part of India is that this flexibility has been maintained so that some escape routes have been kept open and you are not completely bound down to whatever is claimed by this Brahmin or that Brahmin as the dharma. Although Brahmins have tried that whatever they say is the final word and it is to be imposed upon everybody, and socially very often some of the Brahmins have become very powerful and they impose their will. We see, for example, in the life of Sant Gyaneshwara. Sant Gyaneshwara had two brothers and one sister, so there were four in all. And they were born from a sannyasin who had broken the law of sannyas and got married and then had four children. And when the dharma shastris came upon this Brahmin and said, because you had broken the law of shastra, because a sannyasin should never get married, you got married, you broke the law of sannyasa, therefore your children will not be accepted in our society. And they were thrown out. Then this Brahmin, seeing that his children will be the sufferers, he went to dharma shastris and said, tell me what prayashit I should do so that my children will be taken into the society. And dharma shastris debated on and on and on for quite some time, and they gave a horrible decision that if you commit suicides, both of you, husband and wife, then your children can, this is the prayashit you should do. Now this Brahmin and his wife both threw themselves out into the waters of the river one day And next morning when the children got up, they found the father and mother were not present. And then they went out in search of food and shelter and protection and all that. But these Dharma Shastris were not even then satisfied. And they said, although that prayaschitta was done, it is good for them, but not for you. So these children had to wander about from village to village, town to town, and they were not accepted. Until one good Brahmin accepted, and then Ganeshwar, of course, at the age of 19, he wrote the full commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. It is even today regarded as one of the greatest commentaries on Bhagavad Gita. So such a great man, at the age of 21, he himself went to Samadhi by his own will. So all the work that he did and marvels that he did in his life were done by this young man by the age of 21. So such a great genius had to suffer at the hand of Dharma Shastris. Such instances we find throughout the history of India, where in the name of Dharma, so much what is called wrong is done in the society. And that is why in India there is always a question, what is Dharma? And even the people who do not know much about Dharma, they always ask the proof of Dharma.
But here the Swadharma is broken by parents, by suicide.
Now we shall come to that question. Is it really so? What is Swadharma? That is our question actually. But I am taking you round and round on a long path so that we shall come to the real point in a short time. But unless we have full background, the concept of Dharma, Swadharma, Yuga Dharma, Rashtra Dharma, all that is interconnected.
Can be translated as Dharma only, no other word in Hindi or Sanskrit.
Because the word Dharma is that which holds together.
No, but the Nyuti is translation is Dharma only.
Even the translation is not correct.
That's not correct, but that's the only word available.
No, we have another word also, we shall come to that. But this word Dharma has arisen from Ripa. That which holds the whole universe by supreme knowledge of the supermind. This is the real meaning.
That is Dharma Dharayati Prajat.
That's right. Everything that is held together. Even today, therefore, there is a question, what is Dharma? And then arose a further distinction in due course of Yuga Dharma. We say that Dharma changes. At one time it was thought that Dharma is inviolable, it remains permanent in eternal. That is why we have the concept of Sanatana Dharma. The Dharma is eternal. But then there was this new concept that Dharma also changes. And yuge yuge, every age it changes. And then there is a concept of Rashtra Dharma. And then there is a further concept of Kula Dharma. And then there is a concept of Swadharma. So there are so many hierarchies of dharmas. Now the word duty means any action that is obligatory upon you as a result of your relationship with the totality or in relationship with the country or in relationship with your clan or with your family or whatever other institution to which you belong. But since it was now admitted that from age to age Dharma can change, from society to society, the Dharma can change. Even the institutions in which we are living, even when they change, Dharma duty can change. And according to my family's conditions, my duties can change. And in my own respect, as I develop, I also can have a different kind of duty at different stages of my life. So, as a result, we have a very complex notion of duty. And that is why Sri Krishna says that karma is a gahana gatihi. what is the right action to be done is very difficult. And we should know what is karma, what is akarma, what is vikarma. And Bhagavad Gita is one of the greatest expositions in which, in one word, it is said that dharma is that which comes to you as a command of God. You don't go to shastras, don't go to anything. You should simply connect yourself with the divine, discover the divine's will, and act according to the divine's will. Short of this, everything is controversial. In fact, the whole Gita's question arises because of the conflict between two dharmas, whether you should fight for justice, which is also dharma, and whether you should kill, which in a certain sense is a dharma. Not to kill is a dharma. To fight for justice is dharma. Now, how will you fight for justice if you are not able to kill? This was the basic problem with which the Gita starts. And Sri Krishna's ultimate answer is, sarva dharman parityajya. You give up all dharmas. Mam ekam sharanam raja. You come only to me, and I shall deliver you from all the sins, all that is wrong, and therefore you should not worry if you approach him. This is the final word of the Gita. The question is, how can you reach the supreme will for which the whole Gita is expounded? What are the means and ways by which you can approach the divine? And one of the important things is that you do every action that you do as a sacrifice. By doing sacrifice, you will approach the divine, and little by little, the divine will also invade upon you. When you offer to the divine takes hold of your hand, at least, in an offering. And then divine enters into you, and gradually you are completely invaded by the divine. This is one of the ways which Sri Krishna expounds in the Gita, that if you do all your actions as a sacrifice, without this desire for any fruits of action, then your action will be the right action. It's the shortest formula given of dharma. Now, this may be in conflict with what other people may call dharma. Many people, like Dhritarashtra, said that Sri Krishna taught Arjuna a wrong thing. When Arjuna was prepared to go away from the war, which would have saved all his 100 sons and all his kingdom as it was, Sri Krishna gave a teaching and asked Arjuna to fight, even when Arjuna was ready to go away from the war. So according to him, Sri Krishna taught something which was not according to Shastra, not according to Dharma. So there can be different opinions on this subject. But Sri Krishna's criterion of knowledge is, whatever is known by the Supreme, and Supreme has a Supreme Light, Jyotiruttamam. He is a creator, therefore his knowledge is the highest. Therefore anything that comes from him is a real dharma, is the right thing to be done. Or you might say that if it conflicts with any dharma, jatva sarva dharmani, you throw away all the dharmas. Even if it is in conflict with dharmas, do not worry. You discard all dharmas, because this is the right thing to be done. In other words, the supreme teaching of the Gita is to go beyond dharmas to the divine's will. Therefore, what Sri Krishna has taught is not a lesson in duty. Sri Krishna did not say that it is your duty to fight, therefore fight. Sri Krishna's answer is, it is divine's will that you should fight, therefore you should fight. That is his ultimate answer. Now, what about the concept of Sanatana Dharma and other changing dharmas? Sanatana Dharma is whatever is obligatory upon you eternally. There is something which is obligatory upon every one of us eternally. Whether you are born now or later on or 100 ages ago or 100 ages henceforth, there is some such thing which you can call Sanatana. And India has recognized this fundamental thing, Sanatana Dharma. Now, what is that Sanatana Dharma? It is only this, the divine will. What Sri Krishna has explained here, follow the divine will which comes from the supreme knowledge which is creative of the universes. That is Sanatana Dharma. It will always hold everything together. Other things may not hold together, but Sanatana Dharma, if you can discover it at any time, it is that which will hold everything together. That is why Sri Krishna in the 4th chapter says that one who knows the divine will and acts according to the divine's will, he works for Loka Sangraha. Sangraha is unity. Loka means peoples. That action which proceeds from the divine's will, and that is the mark of a divine worker, mark of the supreme karma yogi. When he does it, automatically his action will be such which will keep people together. Even though for the time being it may seem to be destructive, it is that which will put people together. It is said that Mahabharata was a huge slaughter of mankind. A huge slaughter of people. In the whole battlefield, all were massacred excepting 5 Pandavas and Sri Krishna. Otherwise, the entire battlefield was finished. All who participated in the war. So it might be said that what Sri Krishna taught brought about almost complete destruction on a huge scale. But it should not be judged by immediate considerations. It is that war which brought about the ascension of the throne, on the throne of Yudhishthira. Yudhishthira could come on the throne, who could establish Dharma Rajya in such a way that afterwards the history of India could continue on right lines, at least for ages, and brought the peoples of India together. And Loka Sangraha was achieved. So even though for the time being the divine's will may seem to be destructive, ultimately that will puts people together. And only divine can know it because he has the supreme knowledge. So there is Sanatana Dharma, which is the will of the supreme, which if known can be regarded as Sanatana Dharma.
But how is it that Janakadi, he is mentioning the name there, Loka Sangraha. Janakadi, Janak also
was the karma yogin. He also knew the divine's will. Janaka and other kings who acted in the spirit of karma yoga, they had contact with the divine's will, and therefore they could bring about the Loka Sangraha for a long time. Even Sri Rama was able to bring about Loka Sangraha for a long time. But the fact is that this Loka Sangraha, after some time, begins to weaken. Of which Sri Krishna says, Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. From time to time, from yuga to yuga, the dharma begins to decline. Now, if there is something like Sanatana Dharma, then why should dharma decline? If there is eternal dharma, why should it decline? The reason is that the knowledge of the divine's will cannot be easily obtained. Unless you do yoga, you cannot know what is the divine's will. So what happens is,
for the divine's will, we are not doing the real.
You are right. That is why.
So,
that is why for a yogi, It is a very big problem. Therefore, there has to be what is called a progressive way. Before you come to know the Divine's will, we go according to Yuga Dharma, Rashtra Dharma, and other lower dharmas. We make it at a ladder. The defect comes when you take all these dharmas as binding forever, supremely binding. If you say this is only a crutch or only a means of ascension, a kind of a help on my way upwards, it changes the character. To take any dharma as binding forever and thinking it to be eternal dharma is a mistake. But if you take it as a movement in your ascending consciousness, then you might not fall into the pitfalls which normally happen if you take it to be eternal. So the advice that Indian rishis have given is that when you do not know the Divine's will, then what should be done? It says, you should, in Taittiriya Upanishad it is written, you should go to the best people of the age. Put your question to them and ask them what should be done. And the advice they give, you follow it. Even then, it may not be the eternal dharma. It may not be the Divine's will. But this is one of the ways. Even to find out the best people is difficult. There are so many people who claim to be best. So you want to find the best people is difficult. Therefore, it is said that you should be a constant seeker. You should be constantly in search. This is the best advice given by the Vedic rishis. Be a seeker. Jigyasu bhava. You always ask. And make experiments in your life until you arrive yourself at the Divine's will. Therefore, it is said that this path is not an easy path. There is no way by which you can say that you have a formula which you apply and you'll be right. Such a thing does not exist. That is why if anybody says that this is the law and you follow it, as a temporary measure you can take it. But from the Divine's point of view, there is no such thing. There is therefore vast, brihat, in which there is complete freedom. Until you reach a stage where you go beyond the law of sattva, rajas and tamas, these are three basic laws, as long as you are in the clutches of these three laws, do not claim that you have attained freedom and therefore in the possession of the truth. Secondly, you get seated in the Atman. You become Udasina. Udasina means you are seated on the top of the three gunas. Then you realize the universal self. Having realized the universal self, Atmani Atho Mai, you go first into the self, Atho Mai, thereafter you go into the Supreme, where you have the complete freedom. And the definition of complete freedom is capacity to do anything and everything, either as alternatives or even simultaneously. That is the real freedom. Capacity to do anything and everything, where every option is as good as the other. In our lower being, one option is better than the other. Therefore, there is a conflict whether I should do this or that. So long as you belong to this field as yet, you have not reached that complete freedom. Complete freedom is achieved where you have real freedom to do anything and you are capable of doing anything, either optionally or simultaneously, and where every option is as good as the other. This is the nature of the divine action, which is free. To live in this freedom is the goal that Sri Krishna gives, and that is why he says, Sarva Dharman Parityajya. Therefore, he says, you give up all dharmas and enter into that freedom which can come only from the Supreme. So, till that time, to find a certain law and certain formula, Sri Krishna says, do not have the illusion that you will find a satisfying answer. As an ascension, you can accept one or the other for the time being, but do not be bound by any one of them. So anybody who says, now you tell me Nishchitam, as Arjuna wanted, you tell me one thing Nishchitam, what I should do, this or that, and that I will do, and Sri Krishna does not answer that question, so Nishchitam. His answer is simply this, that you give up all dharmas and come to me, and then you do what I tell you. That is the only one Nishchitam, which is the most difficult thing. So even the concept of Swadharma, in that sense, gets lost. So now to come back to your question, this is the background. Dharma is eternal in its character, therefore Sanatana. But that Sanatana Dharma is the direct will of the Divine. And whenever you can act in the light of the Divine's will revealed to you explicitly, then you can say that you are doing according to Sanatana Dharma, which is the law of freedom. So you may call it Dharma, but actually it's a law of freedom. Then there are other codes of conduct which have been created under different circumstances. What is Dharma in one yoga may not be Dharma in another yoga. Take for example, the method of war to settle the question of justice was a Yuga Dharma at a given time of history. There was no other method at all. Who is right or wrong? What is justice or injustice? How will you decide ultimately? Everybody claims, I am just. If you follow me, you are just. So at one time in the history of the world, there was only one method, that those who claim to be just, they come to fight. And that too, a kind of a brutal war in which massacre takes place, and whoever wins, he establishes whatever he thinks is right. Now this was Yuga Dharma. To our mind today, it seems to be a barbaric law. But other things were not available in the world. For example, United Nations Organization was not created in the world. Even today, if you throw out the United Nations Organization, what is the method of deciding what is right or wrong? Nothing but war. It was to prevent a war that such an institution has been created. So unless you have machinery, which is not barbaric, which is more civilized, unless you create a machinery, the Yuga Dharma will say that, well, if there is nothing else available, then this is the only method of doing it. So from yuga to yuga, dharma changes because of these situations which change. In India, for example, there was a yuga dharma in the time of Sri Krishna and Arjuna that before undertaking any war, there was a dharma, you should try for peace. You should send an ambassador of peace and argue out before you take to war. This was also a method, a kind of Yuga Dharma. That was the right thing to do. If it was not done, then the dharma was not called Dharma Yuddha. Dharma Yuddha was called Dharma Yuddha only when you have tried every method of eliminating war. Now, this institution India had created very powerfully. And to create a situation where the violence is the least, it had declared a dharma that nobody other than a kshatriya can take part in the war. So all others were saved. They had not to take part in violence. And if anybody took part in the war, it was regarded to be wrong. Then it was said that at the sunset, You should cease to fight. That also is a part of dharma, so that war, the massacre is as limited as possible. Even during the war, you should never plunge into the war without warning. You should give pratikara, you should challenge somebody. So warning should be given and say, I want to fight with you. And then you must agree to fight, then the fight starts. Now all this is a part of yoga dharma. If you don't do it, it's a less from dharma.
Sir, that is not wrong when Karna was putting that.
Yes.
And if he was not given any warning.
Yes, quite true. It was adharma from this point of view.
That is not dharma, no?
It was adharma from this point of view. Now this adharma may conflict with the eternal dharma.
Yeah.
Why Sri Krishna said, now you kill him. You might say that Sri Krishna gave a law of which was adharma. It was adharma from what point of view? From the point of the rules that you have organized. Did you organize the war according to the divine's will? Divine's will was only one. Don't fight and give justice to Pandavas. That was the divine's will.
Yeah.
Everybody opposed it.
And that's why.
So that is why the rule was broken right from the beginning, you might say. And when Abhimanyu went to fight with the great Maharathis in the battle, where every Maharathi broke the law. Abhimanyu was killed by 7 Maharathis altogether. Whereas according to the law, according to dharma which was prescribed, it should be one-to-one fight. Others cannot come and join and say that, now look, you keep his hand like this and then I will give a blow. And the third one said that I'll give third blow. And each Maharathi gave a separate blow to this young man. That is why Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that Karna was a part of that adharma. Therefore, it contradicts the dharma which you have established. But over above that, there is a divine's will. And you act according to the divine's will.
And it's justice.
And that is a real justice. So when there is a conflict between one dharma with other dharma, then what is it that decides? Only one law, Sanatana Dharma. Anyway, this is a question which has to be debated and which has been debated at length. For the time being, the question is as to what is Yoga Dharma? At every stage, according to the situations and institutions we have been created, a law is created, a dharma is created. Today, no country can go to war because of the treaty with United Nations. You cannot go to war unless you inform the United Nations, and any such situation is immediately considered by Security Council, and the decision of the Security Council is binding upon every nation which has signed the treaty with United Nations. Now such a dharma has been created now. But when such a situation does not exist, such an institution doesn't exist, then you have other dharma. Now corresponding yoga dharma, even the kula dharma changes, even the swadharma changes according to whatever obtains in the world at a time. It is a part of this dharma that is manifested in the concept of a duty. A duty is, as I said earlier, an obligation upon you by virtue of your relationship basically with your immediate surrounding, and which may be in conflict with other duty which arises when you go and expand your larger environment. Therefore, it can be said that there are all kinds of duties and none of them is absolute. It may be my duty as a son to protect my family against any attack from outside. But this duty can be transcended. Buddha had the duty to look after his wife and his child. He had a duty towards his father. He had a duty towards his kingdom to act as a prince and to accept his kingship when the time comes. This was his duty. And yet Buddha left everything, gave up all the duties, you might say, transgressed all the duties in search of a knowledge. And we pardon Buddha because although he broke a duty, he discovered a greater truth. Now that duty was a greater duty to find out the truth. Is a greater duty for Buddha. Therefore, the lower duties can be broken. And this has been accepted in India, that whenever you have a lower duty in conflict with the higher duty, then higher duty should be performed until you go on rising and come to the highest.
But in our ignorance, there's always a conflict between the lower and the higher duties. So what would make us choose the correct?
Between the two, you follow the higher duty in the light of whatever you know the best.
Ultimately, we ourselves decide.
You, as long as you decide everything, think that it is only provisional. Without bringing the divine, you can never do the right thing. This is the basic message of the Bhagavad Gita. One comment. This is the basic message of the Gita is that unless you bring into account the self which is immortal and the supreme Prabhu and Vibhu, Maheshwara, unless you take into account this reality and bring from him and his decision, and you identify your will with his decision, always think that you are not to assert yourself as the right thing. You can only say, according to my present life, this is what I think is the best, and I can do nothing better than that, therefore I do it. And in my wisdom, you should again say, I offer it to the divine. And say to the divine, O Lord, if it is according to thy will, let it succeed. If it is not according to thy will, let it fail. This is, you might say, derived a kind of a consequence from the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. You do your best according to your lights, whatever is available to you. Try your best. Search. In the light of that, whatever you think is best, you offer to the divine. With this prayer, that all my action I do for your sake as an offering to the divine. I don't know who's the divine. I only know there is a divine. I am told there is a divine. I have faith in the divine. Or whatever knowledge I have got of the divine, into that divine I'm offering. And my prayer further is that whatever is according to the divine's own will, let my action contribute to that divine's will and not to my will. If it is according to the divine's will, let it succeed. If it is not according to the divine's will, let it not succeed. But do your action, having done this, do your action faithfully and fully, without negligence. Yogaha karmasu kaushala. This is the, you might say, the transitional movement. And by this, you will gradually come to know what is the divine's will, and the divine will manifest. So what you said, what you think is the best, your decision, the answer is, enlarge yourself. And before you do anything, you find time to turn to the divine. Make this prayer, and do whatever you think then best with all your heart. Whether people like it or not, you are criticized or not, does not matter. Be faithful to what you are doing. But always keep in mind I will not demand from God the success in my action. Success for His will, if it is not according to His will, let me fail. I don't mind at all. When you arrive at this stage of consciousness, then I can say that you have done your best in your present circumstances. Now, other question that you had raised was dharma, swadharma and duty. Duties are normally known by conventions or by shastras which are written or codes of conduct or laws. Our Indian Penal Code, for example, which is used in our country, is for us the code of conduct. You shall not steal, you should not murder, you should not hurt, you should not do defamation of people, you should be not cheating anybody, no fraud, no dacoity. All these things are laid down. These are your duties as a citizen. You should never do this. And law has said that if you do it, you'll be punished. To accept the punishment is also your duty. So you might say this is one of the codes of conduct. The Constitution of India is a code of conduct. The Constitution of India says that there shall be a parliament, there shall be executive, there shall be a judiciary, and you as a citizen have to follow the principles which are laid down of the interrelationship between the judiciary and the legislature and the executive. And that if the court of law decides one thing, even though it may hurt you, you should accept the decision of the court of law. You can go in appeal until you come to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court final judgment is final and nothing further can be done, and you must as a citizen accept it. Now these are so-called codes of conduct. These are, you might say, dharma shastras of the present day. Now, you might yourself object to all this. You may not agree with the Indian Penal Code. You may not agree with the Constitution of India. But as a citizen, it is duty, your duty to accept it. Because these duties are according to certain laws which are prescribed at present, inwardly, you have a right to disagree. Because you are greater in your relationship with the laws of humanity. If I am a humanitarian and I believe that our Indian Penal Code, which says that if anybody murders, he should be hanged. As a humanitarian, I may believe that hanging anybody is wrong. I have a right to say this. As a human being, I would say that no human being has a right to take the life of another person. Even the court of law is ruled by men. Even the judges are men. The law has been made by men. And no man, according to my understanding, has a right to take the life of anybody. Therefore, if this law says that as a punishment of murder, hanging is the right thing to do, as a humanitarian, as a member of humanity, I can say, I disobey it. On what ground? Dharma as a human being is in conflict with my duty, and therefore I transgress my duty. And there are many occasions where duty and dharma collide with each other. As a soldier in an army, it is my duty to kill anybody who stands as an enemy. It's my duty. If there is a war between this country and the other, then it is right for the state to demand anybody to be a member of the army. And your duty is to accept. If I receive a letter during the war, you join the army, I cannot disobey it. If I do, it is called, I am called a traitor. Then I go into the army and I am commissioned to fight a war on the border. And I find in the opposite camp, the one who is now coming before me to fight is my own brother, in the enemy, as an enemy. My general says, shoot. Should I shoot him? My duty collides with what I may feel as my dharma. It is my dharma to persuade my brother not to be my enemy. Therefore, before I shoot him, I should get the chance of persuading him. That will be my dharma. That to shoot somebody without consulting him, without giving the right advice. At least this chance I should get. So my dharma collides with this duty. So this dharma, which I feel as a member of human family, not only as because it's my brother in an ordinary family, even as a human family, I would say that before you shoot anybody, you should at least have a chance of discussing with him, persuading him. He is going to do this, according to me this is right, according to that may be right. Let us debate together, come to a right conclusion, let us have peaceful relationship, etc., etc. So many things can be done. In our human life, how often justice collides with love? Justice may demand that you should do this, but the love may demand something else. And such occasions often arise in our life. Then which one should I follow? Justice should I follow or love should I follow? And both are good. Love is right and justice is right. Which one should I follow? Therefore, the duties collide often with what is dharma. Now, dharma also may collide with swadharma. As I told you, it was dharma in the time of Buddha to serve the father and mother, to protect the wife and the child, and to take up the duties of a king. It was dharma, not only a duty, but it was dharma. Yet he transgressed all that because he felt that the search for the truth is greater than all this performance of duties. Where is the question before me? Is death inevitable? Is suffering inevitable? Should there be pain at all in this world? Is there a remedy to it? This was the question. And he found that he had the capacity to search for it. For a man who does not have the capacity to seek after this truth, and yet he transgresses his duty, may be wrong. But if he finds that he has a capacity to do it, his swadharma demands what is objected to by dharma, then one should follow swadharma. That is why Sri Krishna says, swadharme nidanam shreyah. Even if you die while doing your swadharma, that is better than following paradharma. Paradharmo bhayavaha. What is right for another person, you should not follow. So this is a further enunciation or further detail of what is right and wrong. But even swadharma may not be the highest. As I told you, the highest is when you are able to give up sattva, rajas, tamas, your own sense of desire, your own sense of results, your sense of egoism that you are the doer, when you can be seated in the self, and then when you can be seated in the Purushottama, then only the right action will really follow. So even swadharma may collide with this. Even swadharma is not the highest according to the Gita, because in the last chapter it says, sarvadharma anparityaj, even swadharma should be given up. You follow only one law. But in a given situation, for you or any civilized person, swadharma is better than dharma, yuga dharma or anything. Swadharma is the best because you have to determine your relationship with the totality of the universe, with the totality of the creator himself. And swadharma is often conceived as what one individual in his highest consciousness considers to be his highest relationship with everything that is the best, and his present condition, his capability. Considering all this, what emerges out of it is swadharma.
And one of the Subhashitis said, Mahajana ayam ratasa pantha.
Yes.
So that means ke Mahajana is Superman, a divine.
Mahajana is usually the collectivity of people. Mahajanaha is a, wherever lots of people move, that is your method. But it is also a temporary law.
That's what I think is maybe Superman then.
No, Mahajana is collectivity of
people. Lokasana.
Local. What now, large number of people are following, there you should go. It is a part of the story of Murkha Panditaha.
Yeah, I know.
Foolish Pandits. It's a story of that where the four Brahmins are traveling and they do not know in which direction they should go, either at the crossroad, this way or this way or this way or that way. Then one of the Brahmins said that we have written in the Shastra, Mahajano yena gataha sapankaha, that where large number of people are moving, it is that wealth which you should go to. Now at that time one merchant had died and there was a procession. And there are a large number of people going in that direction. So this Brahmin said that since it is written here, you should now go to the cemetery. It's a part of the story. But the sentence is correct. The application was not a very wise application, but the sentence is correct. That when you are in doubt, what you should do, then this is one of the methods. Mahajano yena gata sapantaha.
I thought that Mahajana means Mahan, divine.
That also is one of the meanings.
Where he is going.
That is also one of the meanings, but Mahajana usually means a collectivity where large number of people, Mahajana, where lot of people move.
The story it is like that.
Yes.
Can you say Loka Sangraha or
both? Loka Sangraha, now that is the last point that I wanted to make out, in fact. In fact, it is a light on the fourth chapter, which already finished, but it is the point which you can always come back to. Loka Sangraha is the solidarity of the people. Sri Krishna says that one mark of a karma yogi is that he always acts for the solidarity of the people. Even the avatar, when he comes down on the earth, he acts for Loka Sangraha. In fact, it is said that Sri Krishna came on the earth for Loka Sangraha. At that time, because of the abhyudaya of Adharma, because of the rise of Adharma, people like Kansa and Duryodhana, Jarasandha and many others, the rule of evil had ascended to a very high peak. And those who were sadhus, the good people, they were being oppressed. This was the condition in which Sri Krishna came down on the earth. And his avataric work, ultimately, the greatest work that he did ultimately was to destroy all the evil people, or the leaders of the evil people, and to enthrone those good people who were in minority. And he succeeded in doing it. He wished to recognize that Yudhishthira is a Dharmaraj. He himself a great task of the avatar, because everybody did not accept Yudhishthira to be the great, wonderful Dharmaraj at all. People did not accept that the Pandavas were the real paragons of virtues. It is Sri Krishna who knew that although Yudhishthira, Arjuna, Bhima, Sahadeva, Nakula, they had many human faults. It is not as if they were absolutely perfect human beings. But in balance, he found out that they are much better people, and if the kingdom is in their hands, there will be a real Loka Sangraha. The people will be able to get justice and they will remain more united. That is why he took the side of Yudhishthira and fought on his side ultimately. Although he tried his best to prevent the war, that also is a part of avataric work, because preventing war itself would have been Loka Sangraha from a certain point of view. If by keeping everybody intact, without destruction, if he had to succeed in giving some kingdom to Yudhishthira, Then at least a nucleus would have been created where Dharmarajya could have been established. That was even preferable in a certain sense, keeping all people intact and yet capable of giving kingdom in the hands of Yudhishthira and his brothers, so that a nucleus afterwards can grow. Since it was impossible, then Loka Sangraha remained only in one way, destroying all these people, ultimately giving the kingdom in the hands of those few people who were really good and who were capable of keeping people together. Now, from outside point of view, how will you judge whether this was Loka Sangraha or not? As I said earlier, from a certain point of view, people might say that Shri Krishna acted for the slaughter, huge slaughter. Where is Loka Sangraha there? Where was the solidarity of the people? Solidarity was from an inner point of view, one who sees, who foresees. That is why you cannot speak of a Loka Sangraha unless you have foresight, unless you have vision. That is why it is said that the mark of a real karma yogi is that he has the largest vision possible. Even Arjuna ultimately was persuaded to fight because of the Vishwarupa darshan, in which he saw what was happening in the future. Where Arjuna himself cries out and says, I see the Kauravas being destroyed. And Sri Krishna himself says that Dhritarashtras are already killed. Now you only become Nimitta Matram Bhava. There was a vision of the future. Therefore, you cannot decide what is Loka Sangraha unless you have the future's vision. Therefore, our conclusion is that without divine vision, you can never be sure of your rightness of action. All claims of human beings, I am right or you are right, these conflicts are insoluble. There will be always debates in the world. As far as you are concerned, you can find out the truth and the real justice only when you have gone into contact with the divine. Receive his word and act according to that word. And short of it, I told you just now, short of this, you decide at your own level, with your utmost capacity, by consulting the best. Come to a conclusion, what is the best action? Perform it as an offering to the Lord, not claiming it is the right action, but offering to the Lord and saying to the Lord, I am doing this because I have no other higher light. You have the highest light. If my action is wrong from your point of view, please defeat it. Make it successful only if it is according to your will. And you become free from whether you succeed or you fail. When you are in this condition, then be sure that your action is right. This is the criterion that emerges out of the whole teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. All right. I don't know if I answered your question. I have? All right. But then I think we need to
more light this one.
Pardon?
Little more light to Swadharma.
Swadharma. All right, then next time we shall do Swadharma. All right.